Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marco Nunziata, co-founder of Nunziata and Desai Partners, and formerly a chief economist and head of business innovation at General Electric. So I'm an economist, but my expertise is really at the intersection of economics and innovation and technology. And I'm pleased, therefore, to be part of this series of podcasts. And today I'm joined by my favorite co-host, James Villarubia. James.
So much, Marco. It is always a joy to join you on a podcast and have these conversations with you. You bring such a great wealth of experience and perspective. So yes, I'm James Villarubia. I'm currently a Presidential Innovation Fellow at NASA, where I work on AI, trying to integrate AI and sort of complex solutions that evolve AI into how NASA researchers and scientists do their work. Back to you.
And it's fantastic. And thank you, James. And today, let's welcome today's episode's guest, who is Sarah Bitti. Sarah is the founder and CEO of CultureWell. And with Sarah today, we'll be diving into a world that we've all become more familiar with, unfortunately, during the pandemic, and the world that we need to pay a lot more attention to as a society for our long-term health, wellness, and resilience. Sarah has a fantastic background. She has been a medical laboratory scientist, an experienced healthcare manager, professional microbiologist, and with this diversity of experience, she has seen up close the state of infection prevention within healthcare, which has become her topmost concern. And this is what today's episode will focus on. And specifically, Sarah will talk about why she has realized that the need to move from a more reactive infection control approach towards more preventive infection control programs that can only become available by giving healthcare and other companies the necessary data to build more robust and more agile infection prevention programs. So welcome, Sarah. Sarah, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, team. Thanks, Margo and James, for having me on the podcast today. So I'm the founder and CEO of CultureWell. And one of the things and exciting things that we're doing at CultureWell is to really help hospitals have the data and insights that they need to truly get ahead of infections and outbreaks, and specifically the role that the facility itself, the healthcare facility, plays in the infection transmission throughout the facility and how it impacts patients. Because really, the technology that we have, we want to help healthcare professionals understand the role that the facility plays in infection transmission throughout their facility, and that if they had better insights into what was going on, that they could strategically deploy cleaning and infection prevention resources to the areas that need it most, instead of the status quo that is cleaning and hoping for the best.
Great. Thank you for that. So I think our audience at this point is probably pretty familiar with the concept of infection prevention from the pandemic. We all sort of hopefully escaped unscathed relatively, but I know we're still in this battle in a lot of ways. Can you share from your sort of expertise and background, can you share sort of a broader overview of sort of where things are today in terms of infection prevention, sort of how the industry sort of got here, sort of even before the pandemic, and walk us through that history a little bit so we have that context?
Absolutely. So one of the things that inspired me to create CultureWell is that I found through like working as a healthcare administrator and professional microbiologist that the state of the industry wasn't really where it needed to be. And I remember being shocked actually at what was going on, where I just assumed that as a patient, as a general user of the healthcare system, that healthcare systems and facilities were doing things like air monitoring for germs, water monitoring for germs, surface monitoring for germs, because it's actually commonly applied in many other industries, including like the food chain and many other supply chains, including pharma and everything. So it was just like a generic assumption that I had made throughout my career. But imagine my surprise when I found out firsthand that healthcare doesn't actually do that. They used to, though. So the backstory here is that in the 1960s, there was a requirement. 1960s and previously, there was a requirement from the government and the CDC that required hospitals to perform air, water, surface monitoring in their facilities. And you can still see that requirement today showing up in some sort of water management programs, like such as looking for Legionella, but also for dialysis, where like dialysis water is routinely cultured to make sure that like we aren't giving people systemic infections. But that's kind of the extent to where like that type of surveillance for germs goes. And we actually right now in the healthcare industry use patients as our primary surveillance indicator. But if you think about that from a root cause analysis perspective, we're actually allowing the problem to occur and then taking action versus preventing it. And that's the whole point of infection prevention, is that we're trying to stop these things from happening, to stop outbreaks before they start. But unfortunately, it's very reactive and very firefighting. So back to the 1960s, there wasn't any sort of testing standard. There wasn't any sort of like unifying methodology. And so pretty much hospitals could shop around for the lab that gave them the results that were most favorable. And eventually the American Hospital Association successfully lobbied the CDC saying, hey, because there's no good standardization, there's no regulatory framework for how these labs and how hospitals are actually doing this testing in-house or otherwise, that you actually can't put requirements on us to have certain levels of cleanliness based on this testing. And the CDC agreed with that because there was no unifying technology. And while the CDC ultimately over the years was tracking things like infection rates and that sort of thing, it was still very much a reactive mindset. So fast forward to roughly the 2010s, and when the Affordable Care Act came around, there was finally a requirement for hospitals to report to this entity called the NHSN, which is the National Healthcare Safety Network, all sorts of healthcare acquired conditions or healthcare associated conditions, such as healthcare associated infections. So that's instances of like superbug, MRSA, C. diff, that sort of thing. And then one of the other things that happened around that time is that the government itself was really establishing a lot of like epidemiologic reporting, and the CDC for the first time was able to get trend data on what was happening in patients across the United States. And it was a really good way of aggregating this information so future policy decisions could be made. So then we started to see some improvement where CMS actually implemented financial penalties on hospitals that had high infection rates. So, and this is still around today, where the top quartile of lowest performing hospitals, so the hospitals that have the highest infection rate, they actually get a 1% overall penalty, which is a 1% haircut on all of their Medicare reimbursements for an entire year. And that 1% is then given to the top performers there. And then that cycle repeats itself every single year. And there have been additional enhancements since the pandemic. But what's important to know is that we started making considerable progress in this area of being able to understand what's going on in each and every healthcare facility. And because of the presence of these penalties, it allowed people to budget for things like disinfection technologies and encourage people to actually put a larger focus on patient safety. So there's this concept called like the Institute of Medicine actually put out like the seminal article really related to like the do no harm and that sort of thing. But what it did is that it really changed how hospitals addressed patient safety. So the report is called To Err is Human. And there were too many preventable harms going on, and hospitals really renewed their focus on patient safety. And there were many other regulatory requirements coming out around that time from CMS and the Joint Commission. But then we had the COVID pandemic. We were seeing all of this progress, and then COVID hit. And what it did is that it reset the U.S.'s infection rates back to the 2015 baselines that had been established. So we, in essentially a moment, it had erased all of our progress on infection prevention. And what's remarkable about that is that the resources that were typically deployed to prevent all sorts of other infections in the hospital were the exact resources that were pulled to do contact tracing for COVID and all of that stuff. So now when we're in like this semi post-pandemic era, hospitals are actually struggling to re-implement their quality measures that they used to have prior to the pandemic because of the brain drain of people leaving. But all, and I've had many hospitals tell me directly that they no longer remember how they used to do certain things, and they no longer remember what used to be part of their quality programs. And so they will often find things through working with us at CultureWell, such as, like, we'll ask them, hey, when's the last time you changed your patient curtains? Like, what's your process? What's your workflow for changing these? They investigate and they'll say, we actually haven't changed them in more than a year. Like, we only change them if they're grossly soiled. And that's just not the standard of care. But what I want to highlight here is not that these issues are happening or there was this one hospital that it's happened to, but this is actually the reality across the United States. And what also should be highlighted here is that hospitals actually want to fix this, but they don't have the data that they need on their own personal facilities to make a change and to advocate for change within their organization.
Just very quickly, James, I think it's striking that it goes to a core aspect of the problem. It is striking to see that just after we've gone through a pandemic, which should have made it remarkably clear to everyone how important infection prevention is, paradoxically, this leads to a setback. But if I understand it correctly, Sarah, there's something in what you're pointing to, which is the human aspect of all this, right? You've pointed out that hospitals do want to do better. They actually already have financial incentives to do better, and we can talk about that more further on in the discussion. But humans are humans, right? So especially in high-stress environments like hospitals, it feels like they are pulled in so many directions, the doctors and the care staff, that the more big picture data collection, data analysis aspect really becomes crucial to impose a framework and give guidance and establish better practices.
Yeah, absolutely. And what many people have told me from like working with clients throughout the United States is that they know that they have these problems in their facilities, and the publicly available data on medicare.gov/care compare, where you yourself can go in and look at your local facilities and see how they're handling like all sorts of healthcare associated conditions and other quality metrics. But you can also see their infection data, and you can see their infection data over time. Like, the idea is that patients can electively choose to move to a different hospital if they have an opportunity for elective surgery. But then there's also the socioeconomic component as well, where sometimes people can't choose the hospital that they go to, or the hospital that they're choosing is the only hospital that they have access to has higher infection rates and these sorts of things. And so it's kind of like this vicious cycle. But because hospitals actually do want to fix these issues that they have, and they know that these issues are systemic, they're up until like there was a technology like CultureWell's on the market, is that they weren't able to get this level of granularity to their data that allowed them to do that advocacy. But if you think about an entire healthcare facility, like, how many bedside tables are there? How many beds are there? Hundreds? Thousands? And without that type of meta-level insight into, well, it looks like we're always cleaning our bedside tables correctly, but why is it? And this is a real tidbit of data from our information at CultureWell, is that, but why is it the bathroom handrails are always dirty and sometimes never wiped down between patients? But there's human factors to that, right? And so if you think about, like, what is a bathroom handrail look like? Well, it's a 3D surface. It's roughed up a lot, because there are things to deliberately enhance grip, especially if you have a wet hand or something like that. And those are exactly the type of features that make it easy for bacteria and other things to stick around. Couple that with the fact that you have people that are cleaning these rooms, all of these rooms look identical. And if they have any sort of limited hand mobility, it's actually hard to wrap your entire hand all the way around that bathroom handrail to get it clean. And so when they have information about the gaps, like the true procedural gaps in their facilities, they can then say, hey, now we're going to put in a training program that allows us to actually teach people how to clean bathroom handrails, because it turns out it's not intuitive. And so that's why there is this like resurgence of interest in this area, especially post-pandemic. But we can't just go back to the status quo and think that everything's going to be fine. And ultimately, with things like global warming and that sort of thing, we're only going to see more pandemics. We're only going to have infections like malaria, which, and by the way, this has already happened, resurface within the United States. It's very much a global concern that is affecting everyone across the globe. But without the level of data that we need to know, without like a specific level of data, and without like this meta information around what's going on across the country, we won't really be able to systemically solve these problems. And that's why there needs to be this renewed focus on looking at air monitoring again, looking at surface sampling and water sampling again, in a way that actually makes sense and is actionable for hospitals.
I want to make sure our audience understands sort of the great work that you're doing at CultureWell. I know it's always a little strange to talk about your product, but I think it is actually really valuable here because, I mean, drawing from my brief experience in the healthcare space during the pandemic, where sort of the time we were working on sort of notifications for patients, and we realized that the time issue of when we found out when the patient's sample was emitted, when it was tested, when we found out, when then we could sort of contact the patient in an automated way and confirm that, yes, they know that they should stop engaging with others and stay inside, that what any sort of extension of that time dramatically increased the rate of infections within their family, within their context. And it sounds like it, within the CultureWell sort of structure, that you have really optimized the timeliness of this data. And that is such, like, such a key component. Can you walk us through what might be sort of the standard pattern, you know, without CultureWell versus like how you're trying to solve this problem, for hospitals and sort of give them this data that you keep sort of referring to?
Yeah. So one of the things that we do in CultureWell, with CultureWell specifically, is like when somebody hires us, we send a calibrated contractor to come in on site. They know how to conduct themselves in a healthcare environment, and they actually physically take these samples. After collecting these samples from high-touch surface areas, they send it back to our vertically integrated laboratory in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And then they're getting results about 18 hours after the lab receives the samples. And this is all done digitally. It makes it really easy for hospitals to actually buy us, because they don't have to go we're not installing a software. And we also have like what we call like the outbreak response program or rapid response program, where they can essentially pick up the red phone and give us a call and say, we're acutely having a problem. And so they're getting these results very rapidly, but these results are very specific to the needs of healthcare, where these are results that are viability based, because the question that healthcare is asking whenever they take environmental samples, is there a germ that's on the surface after I've already cleaned it that could potentially infect the next patient? And there's this like great yet awful statistic from the CDC that came out in 2021, which was that patients who occupy the room of somebody who previously had an infection are 6 times more likely to get that identical infection. So if that's not the smoking gun for the facilities themselves are the problem, but also the facilities have the power to change this now with data and everything and with this type of collection, it's fundamentally changing the industry.
I want to pause and just like restate that for our audience, because that was, again, like a terrifying statistic. So you're saying that if I'm a patient or my family member is a patient in a room, basically whoever was in that room beforehand, if they had an infection, my family member is now sort of 6 times more likely to get an infection and to be that infection. So if my family just happens to get a room where someone had MRSA beforehand, there's my family member is 6 times more likely to get MRSA. And just the nature of like sharing a room over time. Did I understand that terrifying statistic correctly?
That's correct. And then the longer that the previous patient had stayed in that room, the more likely it's like MRSA, for example, is able to kind of proliferate itself within that room. Mm. Yeah, to the point where it's like even on the ceiling. Oh. And so it causes incredible cleaning challenges as well, where if you just do a routine cleaning once a day, that can kind of keep down what's called the bioburden in that room, But we have data on our side that shows that if somebody was in a room for 5 days or more, you pretty much have to do a huge deep clean, not just a discharge clean. It really has to be scrubbed top to bottom and then usually hit with some other type of device like vaporized hydrogen peroxide or UVC, which are two types of disinfection technologies available like on the market and actually work, thank goodness. But without that type of intervention and targeted intervention, this is really what's happening right now. Like people are getting infections as we speak. And they went into the hospital to seek care to get better. But the very facilities that they're seeking for help are actually harming them in sometimes other ways and sometimes worse ways than the reason that they went to that facility in the first place. And that's exemplified by not only healthcare associated infections, but surgical site infections. And then there's also like a socioeconomic component there as well.
I want to sort of follow up on that and then like also pass over to Marco because I'd love his perspective. But I mean, I have a family member who just went through sort of really advanced chemotherapy and was immunocompromised for basically 6 months. And the thing that I didn't know was like, oh man, you got to beat cancer. And it's like, well, that was the reality was, well, you probably will survive the cancer. It's the secondary infections that are more likely to kill you because they just had no immune system. And it was sort of terrifying to me. It's like, we've got this hospital and you're telling me the hospital's not that safe. But they're also sort of pushed very quickly to sort of a nursing facility, which didn't seem particularly better than a hospital in terms of its cleanliness. And it seems like the incentive structure around sort of like where infections are counted, where deaths occur due to infections, that there's a real incentive structure, like an economic incentive structure that is strange given what this industry is trying to do is sort of, to your point, sort of save people and save lives, do no harm. Can you talk about sort of how that incentive structure sort of exists? And Marco, I would love to sort of, what are your thoughts on sort of what this means globally?
Yeah. So talking a little bit about the incentive structure, like one of the scary pieces of data that I came across was that the average number of infection preventionists in any given healthcare facility around the country is one. But infection preventionists have responsibilities such as rounding on every single construction site within the hospital's premises and confirming that the construction dust is being handled and that everything is in compliance. They're also sometimes solely responsible for doing the mandatory reporting to the NHSN, like I mentioned, but they also have to look at their clinical microbiology laboratory surveillance data, which patients in what units have what infections, and do we need to take an intervention? And furthermore, some hospitals even do not have the type of technology to track or trend this very well. So when we're looking at that, they might be using just Excel to track this data. Like there's not a lot of additional support. There's some features in the EMR and that sort of thing. But ultimately, we don't have a good policy and structure set up in the United States where, and especially when you look at nursing home facilities and skilled rehabilitation facilities, there's no requirement for an infection preventionist to be even on staff. And sometimes the nurses are asked to moonlight as the infection preventionist for the purposes of the inspection or if there's an outbreak going on. And so we really are not setting these facilities up for success. And furthermore, these facilities rarely have the resources to do a good job with cleaning. The turnover rate is high. And so we kind of have this perfect storm that's ultimately harming people. And you're absolutely right that people are able to survive like some of these, like the biggest challenges that have threatened like all of humanity, which is cancer, but then they still end up dying from a preventable. That's the key thing that I want to make sure we highlight here is that healthcare associated infections are preventable harms that the hospital has failed to prevent. And it's incidental to getting care in these facilities. And so we need to have a better policy structure and policy framework. We need to have infection preventionists in every healthcare facility, and that includes skilled nursing facilities, dialysis facilities, and beyond. And until we really have a look at what's going on and what are these true incentives for things that are below acute care hospitals in terms of like step down for patients and their rehabilitation, the reason that these folks are actually being asked or like discharged when they haven't been healed yet out of the acute care hospital is that the acute care hospital doesn't make money on inpatient stays after 48 hours. And believe it or not, the length of stay attributable to, like, if you get an infection, your length of stay increases by about 6.5 days on average. And so there's a huge financial incentive for hospitals to discharge patients who have infections to these skilled nursing facilities, who are actually are able to handle these types of complex patients. That's why they exist. But without more enhanced infection prevention technologies and without better policies and programs in place at those facilities, the other people in those facilities are more likely to get those infections, and the cycle itself perpetuates. So there's just a lot of opportunity here, and there's definitely a regulatory play that I feel it could be enhanced a little bit more.
And I have a couple of curiosities here, and I feel like, James, you keep hitting us with these data points and this evidence, which is just striking, because partly because it's not what we like to think about, partly because it's paradoxical, the fact that the areas, the places where you go to be cured are then places that really make you sick and place you at risk. And there's, of course, the human tragedy about it. But for a cold-hearted economist like myself, there is also the aspect of the resources, right? Because the fact that if I go into a hospital because I snapped my Achilles tendon playing soccer, which actually happened, and then you get me an infection, which likely didn't happen, places an additional strain on the resources, both human resources and financial resources of the hospital. So I have two questions for you on this, Sarah. The first one is, do you have a sense, or can you give us a sense, because I'm sure you do have it, of the magnitude of the financial cost, the financial burden of this problem on the healthcare system? And secondly, how do you see this moving forward? Because, again, from a purely cold economic perspective, part of my concern is, to the extent that we face the risk of worsening health conditions overall across the population, that inevitably also spills over into a less healthy workforce, more missed days in terms of work, lower productivity, and therefore lower economic growth, which in turn means less resources, including for healthcare.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we looked at when we were building CultureWell is, like, what's really the impact, like, across the United States, not just the social costs, because, like, those numbers are quite higher. But if we just look at, like, what are healthcare companies in the U.S. spending to prevent infections? And so that's, like, the answer is $31 billion with a B. And this is everything from the direct cost of taking care of folks with infections. It's paying for the staff and the workload. It's paying for things like PPE. It's paying for things like cleaning companies, cleaning services, outsourced cleaning, and everything that comes with that, like related to chemical disinfection. But also, like, hospitals are so focused on actually preventing these things, like preventing infections, that they do throw money at it. And they do throw money at these problems where they're buying the latest cleaning technology and they're using these things. However, these technologies are not actually addressing the root cause, which is germs are present on surfaces in the facility. And without knowing where those germs are, you're limiting your ability to deploy and respond to those types of infections and to clean it up. But also, like, this goes straight to the top of the healthcare organization, where, like, doing customer discovery with CMOs and that sort of thing, like, they're telling us that it's a shark bite problem, that they spend 4 to 5 hours a week in meetings trying to prevent healthcare associated infections in their facilities. But ultimately, like, while this goes all the way to the top, without addressing that root cause, we're not really going to see significant traction. So then when we look at, like, how does this actually expand into what's going on in, like, the broader, like, world ecosystem, is that it actually has a lot to do with climate change. And what that means is that, and this will be a really brief overview here, but as the world is getting hotter and is dealing with more extreme temperature extremes, like, our bodies are also dealing with that. But also the germs that are on our bodies are dealing with that, and they're adapting to higher temperatures. And so one of the things I want to call out is the idea that things that historically do not challenge humanity as much as bacteria are things like fungus. And the reason for that is because there is a huge gap between where fungus likes to grow, which is more at, like, room temperature, outdoor temperature. And that's one of the reasons why our bodies like being hotter, it's harder for just us to get like a fungal infection on our skin unless there's some other underlying comorbidity. But as our skin gets hotter and as these fungus adapt to these higher temperatures, we start to get outbreaks, such as like many of the listeners for this podcast have probably heard of a germ called Candida auris. It's causing outbreaks around the United States. And this is something that was thought to just be normal flora and has recently emerged as this pathogen strictly because of climate change. And I could go into that in more detail, but I just want to say that like folks in the global South and everything we know are going to be more susceptible to climate change, but that's also going to make them more susceptible to getting infections. And then when we have healthcare facilities where people can't shop around and they can't choose which facilities to go to, and sometimes just have to go to a facility that has incredibly poor performance, it is more likely to give you an infection than to help you. We need to be looking at the role that plays where we already know that there's issues in healthcare systems related to like the actual institutional structures where people of color are actually more likely to get infections, even when you control for diseases and conditions and everything like that. So it's just so important to for us to keep an eye on and then to look at in the context of congregate settings as well. So when we are in congregate settings, like a nursing home or a prison, or perhaps a colony ship to another planet, we need to be looking at the technologies that are available to us and looking at how are these technologies working and functioning in space, microgravity, and then are these technologies for detecting infections actually going to be able to make the trip? But also, how are we doing surveillance and how are we looking at the populations that are being selected to even go on these trips? And will we have the resources and capability and infrastructure to be able to manage things like infections in these new complicated settings?
I can imagine the sort of shock to me of learning about a lot of these pathogens, that they actually exist in the human body, but we sort of keep them at bay, and then you become immunocompromised and they sort of flare up. So it's not like we can send people to Mars without these pathogens. They're just part of being human.
That's right.
But the climate change thing, I think, was sort of interesting because I totally see that. But I also see sort of on the other side is that we've seen rush to create better and more efficient batteries and technology. But in doing so, have actually started to mine a lot of heavy metals. And heavy metals also create antibiotic resistance sort of growth in the soil. So if you go to like a mining facility that's doing heavy metals, you'll find more MRSA. So, I mean, we're getting sort of attacked from both sides here. So I guess like in my mind, that is our future is looking more dire, but you have data that is sort of, I think, can sort of help us get around this. Can you help us imagine what this future ecosystem looks like when, let's say, CultureWell and similar tools sort of get when we get the regulatory support, they get out there, we start monitoring this data. What can we then do with this that is not the simple sort of solving the problems today, but like what are the problems and solutions we sort of expand on tomorrow and years after?
Yeah, and that's why it's important for us to, number one, have this data and to look at it like individually within facilities. But then like, what if we take a couple of steps back out? Like, what if we look at the meta problem of, oh, for some reason, we happen to have this resurgence of a particular germ in this specific region of the United States? Or are there factors in the hospitals that are having the hardest problem dealing with outbreaks, or health systems that are having the hardest problem dealing with outbreaks? It could just be something simple as they need to switch their disinfectant. And so if we can actually compile this data and be able to process it in a way that allows us to do this type of analysis at scale, we can see trends or look at, are there organisms and like germs growing on surfaces that are predictors for outbreaks or indicators that maybe the HVAC system isn't working correctly. And so ultimately, like as cultural growth and expands and other technologies that are in a similar vein, we can truly learn to understand more about our environment and the roles that they play and the variables that, or the levers that we can pull to actually make a more concrete difference instead of everyone reinventing the wheel every time they have a problem within their own facility.
That's fantastic. And so again, Sarah Bitti, the CEO and founder of CultureWell. It's been a fantastic conversation, and it's one of those conversations that really have a huge impact, because they relate to something which touches every one of us personally, either because a family member or ourselves personally have been involved in relations with the healthcare system, or because inevitably somebody we know and we ourselves will be. So it's something that is close to our heart. I think what I liked about our conversation, sir, has been that you've given us so many striking observations and data points that really make you pause and think. For me, really, the two main, or the main takeaways are the following. One is what seems to be at first sight a very basic problem, right? Because when you tell me I can get an infection in the hospital because in the hospital efficient cleanliness is not ensured, my first uniform reaction is also to think this is bizarre, this is absurd, this is something that should be easily fixed. But you've led us to understand that the problem is a lot more complex, not just because humans are involved, but because the challenges given by germs and viruses are actually pervasive and very difficult. And therefore, this is something that requires two things to solve. One is data and an understanding of data. And the second, and this is my second big takeaway, is an ability to use data in order to change the mindset within the organization, the institution, and then changing the mindset, changing the practices at every level. So for me, this has been fantastic. And these are really the two takeaways that I will keep with me for quite a while. James, what about you?
First, I love the pun of culture well, of both like changing the culture within hospitals, but also like, oh, we can culture diseases better than everyone else and tell you more. Love that. But I think the thing that really struck me was, one, the problem is way worse than I think most people anticipate. And two, oh, wow, we're on the cusp of like a really great solution here that can actually tackle this and sort of change lives, save lives, and also save a lot of money. And I think that to me, I was sort of terrified at some of these statistics, but also excited. It's like, oh, wow, this is could be a transformational moment for health and safety in the US and everywhere. So again, like, this is such a great story. Thank you for sharing with us.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for your time. And I'll leave with like this one last sentiment, where it's not that hospitals and healthcare facilities don't want to solve these problems. They truly do. And it's not that the government doesn't have incentive in place to encourage hospitals and healthcare facilities to do something about it. The one missing data point is that we have lagging indicators of success and lagging indicators of outbreak and infection, and cultural is ultimately the one thing that's going to change that. And it's going to give people within the organization the ability to advocate for quality improvements, such as, hey, can we please switch to microfibers? That's like one of my favorite things to recommend to people, is that if you're not using microfibers in your healthcare facility and you are, or if you are using microfibers and you're using a quaternary ammonium-based compound, ultimately, you are preventing the ability of the microfibers to do their job. But one of the things that we've seen is that every single one of the cultural clients that has implemented microfibers has had a full state change in the level of risk within their facility just from doing that. And while it is relatively expensive to implement microfibers, and which is the reason why any healthcare facility is not using it today, is strictly because of cost. The evidence is out there, the research is out there that microfibers work, but ultimately there's the cost component. And so when we can actually prove that these technologies are effective in those facilities and in those environments, that's what really can truly make change, is data from your own facility that a given product or technology works.
Fantastic. And a bit of culture was, thank you very much again for being with us. And thank you for a great conversation. And thanks to all our listeners for being with us. And thank you, James.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shushandworks.com.